Radio Influence, podcasting redefined.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Welcome in, everybody. Chris Landry here for the Thursday, June 20th edition of the Landry Football Podcast. We appreciate you joining us. Sorry we missed out on Tuesday. Had some medical issues had to deal with. And we appreciate everyone's patience there. Got a little catching up to do. Listen, the news and notes are... Listen, I think everything's meaningful. We've got everything covered up on LandryFootball.com. What's going on, for example, in OTAs, roles going on in different NFL organizations, changes in front office issues. I want to talk a little bit about Pat Bowlen today. I hadn't had an opportunity to do so here in this forum. And certainly college football, there's a lot more news going on there. Lots of recruiting news. Alabama's just had a phenomenal week. Auburn, a really good week. LSU, two outstanding commitments here the last couple of days. So it's been fast and furious with the information. So we appreciate you you're joining us at LandryFootball.com. We're going to get into today. Got a couple of questions we're going to get to, and we're going to get back on the X's and O's series where we are talking quarterbacks, and we've taken you all the way through the point of the snap, what we call the conversion phase, and we're going to get into that and explain that in a little bit of detail. Did want to talk a little bit about Pat Bowlen, who passed away. We've now seen a few owners pass away in recent years. Bob McNair's passed away. Tom Benson's passed away. Just a few of the old guard there and some really good people that have been very instrumental in the league. And, you know, Pat Bowlen is was a great guy and a great guy to work with, great guy to be around in league meetings. Did an awful lot for the sport, the business of sport. I mentioned this on another podcast that I did, that if you like Sunday night football in the NFL, thank Pat Bowlen. He's the brainchild of that, and he was the guy that made that work. You know, Pat Bowlen was one of those guys that was behind the scenes that did an awful lot of good for an awful lot of NFL owners. He didn't take credit. You see the more boisterous guys and the Jerry Joneses of the world that are more out in front and get a lot of the credit and more than happy to take a lot of the credit. Pat Bowlen was not that guy. Just a really good person. I told a story of how he routinely would give guys their bonus, players that didn't quite meet all their incentives, but he gave them the bonus money anyway. He was that type of guy, always looking after players, always cared for players, always did a lot. Just a great, great person, and will be missed. He's been dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's since 2011. And we wish the Bowlen family the best, and we pay homage to him. And what a great leader and visionary he was for the league and what he did for the city of Denver, the state of Colorado, and for football. He was a Canadian guy. His dad was a Wildcatter who made a lot of his money there, and Pat was a really good owner and made a lot of money in real estate and bought, along with his brothers and sisters, 61% of the team of the Broncos from Edward Kaiser, and then a year later purchased the rest of it to be the sole owner of the Broncos and has been for some time. So, again, best to him, best to his family, and we thank him for what he did and what he meant for the league. A couple of questions here. Kevin asks, in 2018, the Supreme Court overturned the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, therefore granting individual states authority to legalize sports wagering. As sports betting proliferates locally, do you think the actual integrity or the perception of the integrity for NCAA football is at any greater risk compared to the days of offshore internet wagering and our street bookies. I'm going to be honest with you, Kevin. I don't know. I am far from an expert on gambling, its effects. Let me tell you the stance that I've been involved with as a college coach, as an NFL coach, NFL and college administrator. The fear with gambling all along was the integrity of the game. And so whether it involves officials, whether it involves players, coaches, anybody that was at risk, not only of just throwing a game, but having an impact, having a relationship with anybody associated with gaming, was always a risk, always a fear. And I think to some degree it is, because if you think about it, what would it affect the integrity of sports greater than the actual integrity of the game? Is the game legit? Is somebody throwing it? There's nothing worse than that. Look, you could have – we've had players. You've had Aaron Hernandez, convicted murderer. He leaves. Obviously, he's taken his life, and we know kind of what's happened there. But survives that. It is the integrity of maybe having lesser moral fiber caliber individuals in the league or in college football. We have a lot of bad dudes that have come around the sport. Support survives that. It's society, right? But if the integrity of, okay, the game is not on the up and up, its stage, it's impacted. We've seen it happen, mostly in basketball. We've seen it happen in a few scandals. It could affect it more in basketball. We saw, it's been forever and a day, but the White Sox scandal in baseball. Could it be done in football? Yeah, it's a lot more difficult. A quarterback could have a great deal of effect, but it's more of a team game, more players on the team. So it could have an effect. Is it a concern? Yes. Now, to answer your question, is the fact that it's getting legalized, does it make it more of a risk or less of a risk? Kevin, I don't know. Again, not being an expert on gambling, but I do understand, obviously, gambling lines are based upon what the perception that the public has of the two teams in. So the goal is for lodgemakers, it's to set the line to get an even amount of money on both sides. Fans adjust to that. Now, what you're asking is the integrity, okay, more people betting legally. Well, the fact that gambling is becoming more accepted and getting maybe legalized more and more to where eventually it'll be legalized all around the country, I think people are accepting of that as a betting public. Just like you can go to the casinos in a lot of parts of this country, why not be able to do that legally? Well, that's different than how it affects the player. Because a player involved, a coach involved, I don't know that there's any difference. I mean, I would think that if you made the betting public, it was legal, you could legislate it more, you could tax it, you could do a lot of good with it if you do it. And it's probably a good thing to do from an economic standpoint. But I don't know if it makes it less or more likely that a kid could come and become involved and throw a game. I really don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I think the integrity of the game has always been a concern and always will be. And, you know, it is one of those things that I think particularly the NFL, but college football as well, they kind of – are holier than thou in how they don't want to have ties to gambling. Yet the fact that people gamble and play fantasy football is the very reason why that the NFL is the most popular sport around. I mean, there are more people bet on the NFL than any other sport. That's why it's the most popular. Fantasy football is bigger in the NFL than – you remember fantasy football was a baseball thing? There's football. Fantasy football is where it's at now in terms of popularity. So I don't know that just the offshore and the street bookies, now is it more or less likely that a player could be approached by someone to do something that would affect the outcome of the game, I don't know that that makes it greater or lesser. I really don't. Wish I had a better answer for you. Next question. If you take an exceptional 4-3 one-gap defensive tackle, the likes of Gerald McCoy, and then are told he doesn't fit a 3-4 one or two gap system, is that basically implying that he isn't capable of consistently stalemating double teams? Well, a 4-3 one gap guy can adjust seamlessly, should be able to adjust seamlessly to a one gap system. The big thing is not whether the alignment's important, but in the 3-4, they probably got him shaded. In a 4-3, an elite guy like a Gerald McCoy is the 3 technique. So he's playing a similar technique, and he's a penetrator to get upfield. So the adjustment, the biggest thing is the one-gap scheme versus the two-gap. Absolutely, you got guys that are better one-gap players than two-gap players. And what it is, it's not implying, it is absolutely, you know, stating. One guy is... he doesn't play the strength game quite as well. Meaning, you know, Snacks Harrison is a great run defender and he can't rush the passer because his strength is ability to hold the point, control two gaps, not getting upfield, just builds a wall, and that's what he does. The one-gap guys are the guys that can be effective versus the run, but they're slipping blocks to get upfield and penetrate as opposed to holding at the point of attack. So absolutely, it's directly correlated to the size and the strength of the ability to control a gap. That's exactly what it's saying. You know, Warren Sapp was a one-gap penetrator. You know, I mean, you can go down the line of the guys that are penetrate, get upfield. They're one-gap guys. Two-gap guys are the guys that hold the point, strong at the point of attack. The other question is in the NFL, on a forward screen pass, if an offensive lineman initially blocks a defensive lineman, disengages, and they gets downfield before the ball is thrown, does this constitute an illegal man downfield? Yes, it does. Is this a difficult penalty for officials to identify in real time? That's pretty easy on a screen pass. First of all, it doesn't happen a whole lot on a screen pass. I think it can be... when you disengage, it really shouldn't be that difficult. With the responsibilities divvied up, it shouldn't be that difficult. Is it missed sometimes? Yes. The issue is that on a screen pass, if the ball is going to come out, even on a delayed screen, pretty quick. So, you know, the delayed screen, it's more of an issue. The predominance of most screen passes, it's not likely that a guy's going to get downfield enough. Where the biggest issue and the biggest problem, you're not asking this, but let me just mention it. The biggest problem that we have is the RPO game. And it's more of a college issue than an NFL issue. That's the biggest issue we got that is not being called. And a run, RPO is run pass option, right? Okay. Well, when you run the football and you come out in a run blocking set and you're coming off the ball and run blocking, but the quarterback instead decides to pull it down and throw it, that's illegal all the time. When in most cases, guy's getting down and he's run blocking and is, you know, it's illegal. It's rarely called. Is it happened so much? It's a big issue that, quite frankly, you know, all the rules and all the calls seem to favor the offense, and this is another one that clearly the defenses are getting hosed on this, and there's not a whole lot of complaints. Well, there is a lot of complaint about it in the football world, but you don't hear a whole lot of fans complaining about it because, you know, as long as it favors the offense, that's what people get more excited about. And I get that, but you talk about, you know, now doing something that is illegal and potentially dangerous, it's a problem. It's no doubt a problem. All right, I want to get back to the X's and O's series and the quarterback, the snap, the conversion phase. And let me just say this. Good teams never minimize the importance of the center exchange. And it's becoming more and more difficult today with the college game, so much shotgun. You don't see guys taking the center exchange. But I got to tell you, let me give you an example. When I drafted Steve McNair out of Alcorn State, Okay, so we're talking in the mid-90s. It took an entire week of our first minicamp practice to get him to properly execute the quarterback-center exchange. Everyone takes that for granted. It is not to be taken for granted from a coaching standpoint. And it is becoming more and more of an issue because so many people don't work on the center. And it's not just that the reads are different, because obviously if you're in a drop-back mode, you're reading defenses while you're dropping back. And if you're running play action and you're faking it, you're turning your back to the defense, you lose sight of the defense, and you got to retain it. You got to turn back and get hold of it. That's a completely different dynamic than working shotgun. So you got a couple of issues that, A, you have guys that don't do a good job with the quarterback center exchange because they've never done it. And so you've got to spend time on it. So you've got to work with the quarterback center exchange early. That's where it starts. And working under center is something that a lot of guys have trouble with. It's also an issue for centers. Centers are used of the shotgun snap, and you know they're not used to snapping the ball to the center. And it is not as easy as you think when you've not done it. So it's something you got to rehearse and practice a whole lot, and it's taught. And, you know, there's something that back in the day you didn't have to spend as much time on. You have to now. Once the snap takes place, then it becomes a mental game with the quarterback. Then it's where the mental part of the game coincides with the physical. If a run play is called, the quarterback has to make sure that the ball is delivered properly to the back, then also carry out the fake after the handoff. Carrying out those fakes after the handoff is critical and can freeze the defender long enough for the back to run through a hole. Okay, you're not giving the ball to a running back. You're handing it off to a running back, and you're carrying out the play fake in a way that you are trying to freeze the defender and give him some conflict of assignment as to whether this is going to be a run or whether you're pulling it out and you're going to throw it. And getting that guy just slightly hesitant is the difference on a running play between a back getting an angle, getting open, and then in the passing game, if you do deliver the fake and you do come out and throw it, it's the difference between freezing that defender and allowing a guy to get free. Back a tight end or receiver. Team is going to pass the quarterback to identify the coverage the defense is in. And, you know, you got to fully recognize coverages. And you got to know where not to throw the football first and then where to throw the football second. And that leads to reduced mistakes. The more the player reps over time, the more he understands what the defense is trying to do to him. Decision-making improves when you know what you're looking at. If you don't quite recognize it, you don't identify it correctly, you're going to take your eyes and the ball to the wrong place. You do it correctly, you take it to the right place. Not very difficult there. Sometimes you have a quarterback, for example, quarterback will come off his first receiver, moves to his second, maybe his third read. It's an indication that he's reading a coverage and the first option is passed over for the second, maybe even the second passed over for the third based upon the coverage. To give you some examples, the very best at doing that in today's game of football, college or NFL, and it's obviously going to be in the NFL that it's more advanced, is Drew Brees. He's the best at post-snap reading of defenses. Drew Brees is. He sacked once about every 23 attempts. He gets the ball out quickly. So the ability to be able to read it quickly and go in the correct place with the ball quickly is pivotal. Somebody like a Jay Cutler was sacked about every 10 times. He held the ball on way too long. He wasn't a smart guy. Vanderbilt grad, seeing the field and reacting to what he saw, he just took too long. In some cases, guys are very smart, but tend to overthink it. They tend to think instead of react. When you can take your knowledge and take your understanding and react to it, it's important. You know, you ever know people that are, they're maybe funny, but it takes them a long time to tell a story or a joke? Then you've got other people that are just, they don't tell a lot of jokes, but they're quick-witted. I mean, something happens and they can drop a one-liner and they're just hilarious. They're both different. One's maybe not smarter than the other. You may perceive one. They're different, but they're both unique in their own way. A quarterback drops back into his pocket, but he has to know where his launch point is on a design play and stick to it. Why? You know, people say, you just run around it. Well, you run around and move around. That's great. But if you do a lot of improvisational movement, remember, you know, oftentimes the quarterback is running right where the offensive line is blocking the defensive line too. Sometimes the offensive linemen, they're bringing the pass rush to the quarterback unintentionally. The quarterback's running right into where the pass rush is. So it's important to understand it. The worst at this was Jeff George. Jeff George floated, and he just did his own thing. And the offensive lineman would block guys perfectly, and Jeff George would just run right into the rush. You know, you say run to daylight, Jeff George ran to darkness. I mean, he floated to darkness. He was the worst. So the offensive line only knows one place to protect, where it's told to. They can slide protect, scat protect, squeeze protect. There are a lot of things they can do, but they only can protect the spot that they think their quarterback is going to throw from. You practice this by putting a dummy in the spot and then running protections around that spot. Young or sloppy quarterbacks who don't stay true to their launch point cause the breakdowns in protection. And oftentimes when you see, well, he's been hit this many times, it's not just he held onto the ball too long, is that he took the ball to the wrong place. Yes, he may have not held onto the ball too long in a given play when he's hit, but he drifted to the wrong spot. And the offensive line is only blocking to protect a spot. Well, if the quarterback is off his spot, the offensive line did exactly what they're supposed to do, and the quarterback caused the sack, even though he didn't hold the ball long. So protecting the spot is what the offensive line is going to do. They're going to protect the spot. If the quarterback doesn't show integrity to that spot, well, then it's going to be a problem. So young quarterbacks, sloppy quarterbacks do a poor job of that. So if a quarterback's supposed to set up the throw from behind the center, but instead drifts 2 feet to the left and winds up behind the guard, how do you think that's going to work out? Not very good. More than likely, they're moving a guy in protection right into the spot where the quarterback is now going to be because he's not supposed to be there. Sometimes a quarterback and his coaches must accept the reality of a situation and set a launch point far away from an opponent's best pass rusher. For example, a play may call for a half roll to the right because the left tackle can't block an elite pass rusher. Sure, it's an admission that the offensive tackle is not good enough to handle opponent. That's part of the evaluation process of the player, which should have been done at this point. But if you've had to live with my left tackle is not nearly as good as that opponent's right end, then you've got to do something strategically to counteract that. Okay? So it's a solution to the problem because the quarterback is moving away from the midline and now has more time to get the ball off before the pass rusher can get to him. If a quarterback doesn't know his launch point and pulls up at the guard instead of the tackle, he's just given a step and a half back to the great pass rusher. Why do that? He's a great pass rusher. He's coming for the backside, and I got to be – my launch point's going to be outside the far tackle, and I pull up short. I mean – think about it. If you put your foot on the brake, somebody's going to pile into you on the highway, right? This is the same thing that you're doing as a quarterback with a poor launch point. When it's designed to get you outside of the tackle, to get away from the pass rush, you must do that. and you must get there quickly with enough time to be able to make the throw and square up, all things that are very important. Quarterback must also know where the escape lanes are and where certain protection schemes won't allow him to go. If a team has a true pocket quarterback, the launch point is, say, the midline, and he'll want to step up into the pocket. Any escape would be through the A and B gap in the middle of the line. In a case of maybe some guy like a Ben Roethlisberger, he has to remember that when the left tackle is working the defensive end to the outside, you got to have the ability to step up inside. You don't want to. If your tackle's blocking the defensive end to the outside, you got to step up through the A gap. You don't run on the outside where the tackle is blocking the defensive end too. So, you know, the natural instinct is to maybe to escape outside the left tackle. If the tackle's working the guy upfield, you try to evade the pressure. That would be, you know, disastrous if you just try to go right into without being on the same page of where the protection is. And everybody talks about same page and use that, throw that out without knowing what it means. Well, we understand to some degree what it's like when you're talking about receivers and quarterbacks, but it's also important to understand from a quarterback protection standpoint and an offensive line protection standpoint where you try to get those things in sync. Throughout the pre-snap mental phase, a play clock is constant. How much time is left? You got to have a clock in your head. You heard that, okay? When you're at the line, you've got large numbers on the play clock in the end zone. But after the snap, clock is running, and one that will cost them more than a delay of game penalty, one that could be disastrous. So a player has to have an internal clock. You got to know how long the play is taking to develop, and you got to be ready to pull the trigger. Delivering the football is where you want to, you know, think about in terms of a play clock. There are differences in the way receivers run the same pass patterns. This is why we talk about, and I talk about a lot, quarterbacks and receivers working a lot with each other in the offseason. How they run, how every receiver on your team is going to be slightly different on how they run each route. Got a post route, everyone's going to be slightly different. Little bit of variance. The quarterback has to remember and be comfortable with all those individual nuances once the receivers head into their routes. The clock also tells the quarterback when it's time to move on to the next receiver in his progression. Any disturbance to the route stem, such as the receiver getting jammed at the line of scrimmage, you got to modify the depth of his route. That affects the timing of the play. That's why you hear me talk about, hey, you disrupt those receivers off the line of scrimmage, you bring good pressure. The design of that play is done. It's over. You can't get off. Your play of getting the ball to that receiver on the first read, you have to abort that quickly, knowing that you're not going to have enough time to get it to that receiver on that particular route. So you better have the second option available to you. And if that guy doesn't beat, you're going to be in trouble. You're going to your third guy. So when you're evaluating, hey, this team's getting good pressure on this offense, people will often throw it on the offensive line. Very often it is the offensive line's flaws. But often it is a receiver not doing a good job getting off the line of scrimmage and getting into his route. And sometimes the receiver does the job, but the quarterback doesn't recognize it quickly. So don't assume that it is the line's fault all the time. It could be the quarterback. It could be the receiver. And I don't think many people think of the receiver as a problem in protection, and it can be. The backs, the tight ends, the receivers, the offensive line, the quarterback, all could be a factor on a given play on a sack. And the only way to know is to understand and be able to study film and know what to look for and see that. And that's what we're trying to explain here. Here's what we tried to do from a quarterback teaching standpoint. We'd have a buzzer on any given route, any play call. That ball needs to come out at a certain amount of time frame. We'd set the clock, 3.8 seconds. Boom. Run the play, 3.8 seconds. The buzzer sounds. If the ball's not out, you've been sacked. You've got to get the ball out. So you've got to prepare your quarterback to get the ball out on time and to go through his primary, secondary, and tertiary reads to get the ball up in one way, shape, or form. And then, of course, it's up to the receiver coach to get the receivers to win in their battle off the line of scrimmage, and the backs to do their job, and the tight ends to do their job, and the offensive line to do their job. So you have to individually teach it, but then you have to be prepared, and you have to prepare your quarterback that if this happens, here's what your read is, here's what your options are, and where you go from there. Finding receivers where you expect them is not always a slam dunk for the quarterback. Most teams use option routes, which gives the receiver the opportunity to read how he's being covered and pick the most appropriate route after the play has already started. Of course, that requires the quarterback and the receivers to see it, both the same, quote unquote, be on the same page. So you don't remember we gave the play call and we called the route for the receiver? You can do that. That's one way to do it. But to create more freedom for the receiver, you can give the receiver a choice route, an option route. But the quarterback and the receiver have to see it the same. Let's say you call a huddle and it's an option route, but based on how the guy's covered pre-snap, the receiver decides that he's going to run a different route. So if the quarterback looks up and see the cornerback lined up on the outside shoulder, he might think that dictates a slant route. Or maybe the corner is 7 yards off the line of scrimmage, which might dictate a fade route. Well, both the quarterback and the receiver have to read the coverage the same. Otherwise, this is where you see, where in the hell was he throwing it? Well, because you'd say, well, he ran the wrong route. Well, he may not have ran the wrong route. He may have chosen to run a route based upon coverage, and the quarterback saw the better option route being different than what the receiver saw it. So, in essence, the reads were not the same from the quarterback and the receiver, and therefore it's an incompletion or an interception with a guy right to him. And it's frustrating for the fans. And you know it's a mistake. Everyone knows a mistake when that happens. But identifying where the mistake is, when you see a ball go clearly where it's not supposed to go, there are two things. It was a design route that the receiver didn't get the call correctly, or the quarterback called it wrong, or something. Or most cases, it's going to be an option route that was read differently between the quarterback and the receiver. Now, there's some plays that have three or four receivers running option routes. This gives the quarterback multiple contingencies to consider, all while dropping back in the face of defensive pressure. There's no end to the things that a quarterback's got to process. So imagine that now. It's post-snap. You've got three receivers all with choice routes. You're deciding while the clock is running down, this is going, he should run a post, he should run a fade, he should run a comeback, and you got to be right. And you've got to know in your number one read where you go. That's not going to be there. You got to go, and all in maybe 3.8 seconds. Have a better appreciation for what the quarterback's going through right now? Will it stop you from booing the quarterback of your favorite team? Probably not. Not as easy as you think. Look, if you've gotten to this point as a quarterback and you've done things correctly, throwing the football is the easiest thing. A quarterback likes to step into his throw. You hear a lot of that. That's ideal. One of the things I do in working out quarterbacks is I want to see his mechanics, I want to see how he throws it, but I also want to see him throw it from different platforms. What do I mean by that? And you hear me talk about that, and I probably don't spend enough time explaining it. And that different platforms is throwing off the back foot in a collapsing pocket. You got to do that. Hey, in everything I've described, you can't always optimally throw it with both your feet under you. You've got to be able to make that adjustment. Well, can you throw it flat-footed? Do you have enough arm talent to do it? Because if you don't and you have to set your feet, well, guess what? Probably not going to be all that successful. Not going to be all that successful. So you have to set your feet. What if you can't set your feet? Don't have enough arm strength? Well, then that's when a quarterback gets into trouble. So this is why physical skills are important. But as we've explained, the mental skills are probably even more important. Tough to play quarterback. Got to have large capacity to learn. Got to have a large capacity, willingness to learn. Okay. So you got to throw the football well. You got to throw it accurately. But you got to make the right decisions on where to throw the football. And hopefully that gives you an idea of where you need to go with the football, how you get to that point, how you prepare. Those things are really important to know and understand before you get to the game. And then when you get to the game, when you're in the huddle. And then when you're in the huddle, when you get to the line of scrimmage before the snap. And then when you snap it, what you do after the snap. We've taken it through the entire process of the quarterback position, folks. Got a couple of questions we want to end on. And I like this question. Somebody asked me about when we talked about the audibles, we heard Peyton Manning made the term Omaha very famous. And people don't understand, what was he doing, why was he doing it, and what does it mean? Well, first of all, Omaha, or any name that you highlight, can mean anything you want it to mean. And the reality is, let's just use the term Omaha. Omaha, the meaning of Omaha changes every week. So one week it might mean go with the play I called in the huddle. Another week it might mean snap the ball off the next sound I give. So you hear things. If you run something and you say red 21 and every play it's run to the right, then they're going to get a read on you if you do that a few times. So Manning would yell Omaha 18 times, and 9 times it would be a pass, and 9 times it would be a run. You don't know. It means – what does it mean? Well, it means whatever you want it to mean. Okay, and you change – okay, this is what it is now. That way, the result of when you call it is going to be different of what you're doing. So decipher what he was signaling. You got to examine all the factors. Where is he when he yells it? How much time is there between the call and the snap? Omaha means nothing. It's just a code for other things, and that code changes and the meaning changes. So even if you crack the code for the game, they'll adjust it between series, between quarters, at halftime. And you sure as hell not going to see them run – you know, Omaha mean the same thing the next game. It's not going to happen. So the answer is the name Omaha doesn't mean anything. It's just a way you call something, and what the meaning is differs. Other than quarterback, what is the hardest position for a new player joining a team to learn? The middle linebacker is the quarterback of the defense. So he's got the most things to learn next to the quarterback. He has to know the fronts, the stunts, all the blitz calls. He's in command of the language that the head coach and the defensive coordinator and the teammates are thinking and using. And if a team brings in a middle backer from a different system, it has to be prepared for him to struggle until he gets the terminology down. I think you always have to allow for that. For example, one team may refer to a particular personnel group as 11, one tight end, one running back. Another team may call it orange. So take the O from one as in a single tight end. A third team may call it ace, again, pointing out that there's one tight end in the game. One team may call three receiver set trips, while another call them trays. You know, people ask, what does tray mean? What does trip mean? It's the same thing. Just call it different. So these little details, but it's somewhat of a different language. And how you do it, how you call it, is a byproduct of your experiences as a coach. And players have to adjust to it, and coaches have to adjust to players. And making that simplified to where everyone understands and you're talking the same language, that's what's the challenge here. And the more important for the quarterback and more important for the mic backer to know that, as they're the ones calling it. They're the ones have to know everything, while other players got to know their responsibilities. It's the mic backer and the quarterback's responsibility to know everybody's responsibility on offense or defense. So really important to understand. Okay, so hope this gives you an idea, a really good idea about quarterback play and how that comes about, how you progress, how you learn, how you evaluate, how you play the quarterback position, how you call things. We're going to move on to running backs next. And on Tuesday, we're going to start talking about the roles there in the running game as it relates to the running back and managing your backfield and how you do different things. So get excited about that. I hope you're liking it. Got any questions, send it to us at LandryFootball.com, and we'll address it. Trying to spend this time, I think, this time of year to get you a better feel for how this stuff takes place, what it means. So when you hear it, you learn it, you have a better feel for how this stuff develops. So we appreciate you joining us. Again, love your feedback, so please send it to us. And we'd love for you to support us on this podcast. If we can help your business grow, give us a call. Hit me at Contact Chris, and we'll get you in touch with the right people that you can become part of this podcast. You can learn and grow from this podcast, your business, that is. We want to do that. Same thing with LandryFootball.com. We want to tie in with good people that we can help grow their business, and we're looking for family members there. So contact us at LandryFootball.com, and we'll certainly get back with you and see what we can do to help you grow your business. And, of course, certainly support us at LandryFootball.com by becoming a member and really taking advantage of what we do in breaking down the game of football, the college game, the pro game, the news and notes going around the league. So we appreciate you joining us, and we hope you have a great weekend. And we'll be back on Tuesday for another edition of the Landry Football Podcast on LandryFootball.com.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at Landry Football. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
Radio Influence strives to bring you excellence in podcasting. We work with personalities like TV chef Brian Duffy, radio personalities like Ian Beckles, news and political pundits like independent journalists Frank and Tracy Beans, experts from the sports world like veteran football scout and coach Chris Landry, pro wrestling personality David Penzer, MMA experts Jason Floyd and Daniel Galvan, and strength and conditioning coach Jeff Crochelle. If you're looking for food, sports, music, entertainment, politics, no matter the topic, Radio Influence has something for everyone. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.